What is your greatest fear? Speaking in public? Spiders? Snakes? What makes us afraid? Today we discuss the psychology of fear with psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you both.
Hi, Mindy.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so fear is one of our primal emotions, and explain this, has both a biochemical and emotional response?
Yes, most definitely. I call it the emperor of all emotions because it seems to rule our emotional life and our behaviors above other emotions. You can't have happiness, for instance, if there's fear involved. You can't really have a successful sexual function if there's fear involved, actually. That's an important thing. The reason that we have evolved to where the point we have really has to do with fear, because if an organism early on, millions and millions of years ago, didn't have a very good mechanism to respond to threat or danger, he would have become lunch for some other predator, and therefore would not have reproduced. So you can think of fear as kind of the first emotion that was selected by evolution to survive and evolve. So fear has is very much ingrained in our brains at a very basic level. We're more or less biased to perceive danger when there isn't there, when there actually isn't danger, because the organisms that erred on that side survived, whereas the organisms that erred on the other side, thinking it, that it's safe when it's not, did not survive. Yeah. So we are automatically programmed to experience fear, even when it's not. And the other important thing is fear is processed by centers of our brain that are not conscious or aware at all. But we feel the both the emotion and the physiological response before we are even aware of it.
And so the biochemical thing is happens in all of us the same, but the actual emotional response is very individual.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think I'd probably have to start off by disagreeing with just about everything Mark said.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. Let's hear it.
Well, at the same time, acknowledging that there is a huge body of research that Mark cites, and which I happen to also disagree with, there are some basic researchers who say when we're born as infants, we have three ironclad emotions or seven ironclad, the sort of the basic core emotions that we build on. I simply don't think that's true. From my work with kids of very young ages and also as adults, it's very important to accentuate that, as Mark says, we have this physiological arousal sense based on the central nervous system, which we are born with, which is a defensive mechanism, which is a protective mechanism. All that's true. But it's just an arousal. Something gets our attention, almost like a metaphorical tapping on the shoulder saying, hey, there's something going on, you know, pay attention to this. And that is a discrepant, sort of a discrepancy analysis. We're looking at something, and our central nervous system is hardwired to notice discrepancies in our environment. But it only becomes a negative emotion. It only becomes fear or happiness or excitement when we label it as such. Infants are born without fear. We know that from our studies from decades ago. Infants are born without fear. That's why parents are so frightened about what their infants are going to get into. They have to watch them like a hawk. They're not afraid of snakes. They're not afraid of barking dogs. They're not afraid of, you know, crawling off the edge of the table. They're not afraid when their parents first start screaming at them. They just don't get any of that. Only after they're conditioned to negatively make a cognitive attribution, which is, oh, I should be worried about this. Oh, I should be worried about that. Oh, this is something that's not going to be pleasant. However they attribute in their head, it's really a learned response. And there are many cases where there are some folks who just aren't scared of things at all. Some folks are terrified of spiders, others aren't. Some folks are terrified of snakes, others aren't. Why is that? Well, if we had a basic natural fear response to everything, then we'd all be afraid of the same things. But it really depends on our cognitive appraisal. That's why we can condition fear into people. As one of the famous psychology experiments gone awry years ago called Little Albert, conditioned fear of a very harmless white rat into this little child. But they, as I recall, they never bothered to condition it out of him until years later. So we can condition ourselves, and we do condition ourselves to be fearful of things. And when you go to a skilled therapist, they can condition you to be not afraid of those things. But and to start it with, Mark talked about, we all share the same physiological arousal into our central nervous system. That is a basic protective mechanism. Then we have to kick it upstairs to our cortex, our more developed brain, to determine if it's something we need to be afraid of or not.
Yeah. But if you go back to infancy, the infant doesn't have any cognitive upper brain, really. That's to be developed over the years. But he still has a response. And I think one of the you can – maybe we're reading in that it's fear one of them would be a fear of pain, pain of hunger, pain of being not touched, held. That, I think, is just automatic, like an instinct.
Well, I think that's a conditioned response to that, fear of something. Certainly it's reactivity. And after you're conditioned to it, if you hear, hear a loud noise like I'm tapping the table, that means something to you. But only after we get conditioned to it. Mark is right that there is cortical development. Not everyone is born with a fully developed brain.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And certainly in our frontal lobes, now we know research indicates that people don't get their frontal lobes fully myelinated until age 21 or 22. Mm-hmm. Now this is some suspicion it doesn't get done until 26, 27. Mm-hmm. And now we know we regenerate as well. So our brain is always developing. And Mark is right about that. Sure.
So I guess it would be fair to say then we develop specific fears as a result of learning. That's true, right?
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Yep. So we have that bit of fear that prompts that, flight or fight or flight response. But extreme cases of fear can prompt you to freeze in your tracks, right? I mean, so, and that would be individual as well. Because I'm thinking, if something really, scary was said, I have a feeling I probably would freeze.
Yeah. Overwhelm.
Yeah.
Overwhelm you.
And that's what's happening in your brain is you're just like, oh.
It's your reaction, at least motoric. Motor reaction is frozen because the emotional state is so predominant that you can't at least figure out. Whereas, say, if you're in a war situation, you've been trained to not allow that to happen.
Right.
And therefore, you can succeed or get through it.
Right. That's true. That's why they want to take people as young an age as possible and train them, if you want to be a soldier, is not to respond to fear, not because you don't have any fear, mm-hmm. simply because you don't let it control you. And if you're going to become a martial artist, go from a white belt to a black belt, not as though you don't have any conditioned responses about your reflexes. It's you're trained to overcome them, so you don't think about it. As soon as you start to think about stuff, that's when the trouble starts. As soon as you start to think about these things, if you just maturely react the way you're trained to, you can minimize a lot of these automatic responses.
That is so interesting when you say that, because I'm thinking back, and I know I've given this example before, but I used to be on this ski team when we'd race, and you look down and you go, ooh, it's pretty icy. Mm-hmm. And you got that fear of the ice. Oh boy, this is going to be bad. And one of the guys on our team was really great at saying, don't let the ice get you. You get the ice, that kind of pep talk. And I was amazed at how we didn't fall, because we weren't thinking about it. It was like, I'm not going to be afraid of this ice. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
That's really amazing how that works.
Well, it's important to understand that if you don't have, Mark was talking about a skill set, but people don't understand that a knowledge set is way, way different from a skill set, I guess we can all go out there and do brain surgery, but not all of us have that skill set to do that, But so we have the knowledge about it. We can watch a PBS series on Operation, but we don't have the skill set. So you were just describing a skill set, and you had the skill set to permit your body to take what we call procedural memory, motoric memory, to overcome these things. But someone like me who could not ski on ice,
fall.
I'd be dead. You'd have to carry me off the mountain.
But the other piece of that is that the influence of the group and the team spirit, whatever, which exists in on the battlefield too, in armies, that's a manipulation of fear. Yeah. And in that way, it's a positive one.
Exactly. Yeah. We're talking about the psychology of fear. If you'd like to join our conversation, or if you have a question, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. What would you say is the difference between fear and anxiety?
Well, again, it's an attribution, but I think the most common definition is if you're afraid of something or if you're worried about something, it has a particular focus. I'm afraid I'm not going to pass this test. My teacher's going to yell at me. I didn't get my homework done. My parents are going to get angry because I did such and such. I can identify it. I can pinpoint it. And anxiety has very much the same attributes, except that you can't identify what it is that you're so worked up about. And so we use those terms in America interchangeably, and it does us a disservice because we group together stage fright, performance anxiety, fear, worry, nervousness, anxiety. We think they're the same thing, and they're not. They're real different. So The difference is with an anxiety issue, you really can't put your finger on exactly what it is. You just, I don't know, if I feel, I just don't feel good about this. Whereas worry, like, oh man, I am in such deep trouble because I didn't do such and such. The second one goes into what Mark was talking about. It's a very healthy kind of response because it keeps us protected and safe because it tells us the things we should be doing. And the second one, the first one, anxiety really serves no purpose whatsoever, which is why people can say, well, don't worry about that such and such, because they're really saying that you can overcome whatever's going on. First, you have to identify what it is. And once you do it in like a problem-solving paradigm, then you're able to overcome it. And you're not anxious about it. You might still be worried, can I bring my A game? You know, the presidential election, that they're probably both candidates are worried, am I going to get elected? But they're certainly working toward that, but they're not anxious about it. They know exactly what they're worried about.
Sure. The other difference to point out is that fear is more basically associated with behaviors of running away and or fighting, physical kind of activities, physical behaviors, whereas anxiety is more concerned with feeling that the future is uncontrolled or bad, or the present situation is bad and it will continue. There's more of a cognitive sort of paralyzed aspect to anxiety, whereas fear, there's more of a motor solution to it, associated at least.
Yeah. It was an analysis of the most frequent online search queries that involved the phrase fear of, and I thought this top 10 list was a good one. It was flying, heights, clowns, intimacy, death, rejection, people, snakes, failure, and driving.
Yeah.
And I bet everybody can go up. Yep. Yeah, there's a category.
Sign on to one of those.
So what about something that, you know, intellectually you can say, well, this is a very irrational fear. You know, this garden snake's not going to hurt me. Right. But, it seems irrational, but yet at the same time, you're afraid.
Sure. Well, there you're talking about two parts of the brain that are really in conflict. One is the primitive, unconscious part that takes in information. And for some reason, there's been an association with snakes and real threat and danger. And it's interesting, that's probably cross-cultural too, in a lot of different cultures, snakes for some reason.
That's true. And a lot of different explanations over the years, from biblical explanations to, you know, other kinds of explanations.
Yeah. So there's got to be a biological piece to that.
But you would think if there's only one universal fear, it seems to be fear of snakes or snake-like creatures. Mm-hmm. That seems to trigger something.
Yeah.
And maybe it's something what one of the old analysts, Carl Jung, would say the collective unconscious, a universal kind of institutional, intergenerational transmission of a fear memory, which it, I suppose is possible.
Yep.
But there does seem to be one universal for most folks. It's a fear of snakes until you condition that away from you.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And let's talk about movies for a second, because I know when I'm watching, a movie that's a suspenseful movie where you're on the edge of your seat, I can't take it. I'm there, and although I'm really not, and so I'm reacting to what's happening to somebody else.
That's right.
You need to close your eyes.
I do sometimes.
This is actually good advice for a lot of people going to movies. You know, you go to a movie and you can sort of sense something is coming up that you really don't want to see, and that could be anything.
Yeah.
Not so much fearful, just something you find distasteful or you don't like. You know, what the writer, what the director is trying, just close your eyes and don't let it in your body, because a lot of this stuff is hyper-activated by just the briefest little glimpse of something. It goes in through our visual processing system, and it goes in the computer. You want to keep garbage out of your brain. Mm-hmm. It's easy to kind of keep garbage out of your brain when it's only auditory. You got the old thing about someone putting their hands over their ears going, not listening. That's a good way to keep garbage out of your brain auditorily, but we are such visual creatures that we don't think that we should just close our eyes and don't let that stuff through our eyes, because as soon as it gets in there,
you can't get rid of
it.
Yeah, so true. Well, I remember that movie Alien when it first came out, and I was closing my eyes, and the friend with me said, "I paid $5 for this movie. Open your eyes." But yeah, no, it's a little scary. And I told you guys a story before we went on the air. My grandmother, I remember as a kid asking her if she believed in ghosts, and she said, "Do you think I could live in this house by myself if I believed in ghosts?"
So she was. But what about what FDR used to talk about during the? I think it was the war that. Depression, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Right.
This goes back to what Mark talked about. We can be conditioned to fearful situations, and then we do become reactive in anticipation of fearfulness. So that's actually quite true. We condition ourselves to be fearful creatures. We can condition ourselves to be fearless creatures. It's not right. wise to be fearless about everything. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people's fear of an anticipatory fear of being fearful about everything is really very self-destructive. We should try and avoid that.
Right. Well, this also raises the question about why some people can condition themselves to be fearless or not so fearful of something, whereas others can't. And if you just take the example of post-traumatic stress disorder, about 20% of people in New York close to the buildings that collapsed developed PTSD, but 80% didn't. Mm-hmm. So there's something, what's different about those people? They both had the same experience. There is one piece of biology that's been elucidated lately that bears on this, I believe, that shows why some people are a bit more vulnerable to anxiety conditions, of which PTSD is an example, than others. One biological piece of information that explains why some people are more resilient than others. And it's very interesting. Let me explain. First, a little bit of basic biology. We all have 46 chromosomes, 23 of which come from our mother, 23 come from our father. And it's, obviously the mixture of these that make us the biological beings we are. On the 17th chromosome, there's a particular gene. That's a gene is a piece of DNA that codes for protein making or synthesis. It codes for what we call the serotonin transporter on nerve cells, which is merely a protein on the surface of nerve cells that serves to transport serotonin back into the cell to be used again. At any rate, this gene comes in two versions. It comes in one that is short and one that is long. So if you inherit 50% from mother, 50% from father, each individual has a chance of having two shorts or a long and a short and two longs. Well, it turns out that makes a difference. Hmm. The people with two shorts are very much more prone to having anxiety disorders. They react more strongly to anxiety. The people with a long and a short or a short and a long are in between. And the people with two longs are the resilient ones. Hmm. They will probably not develop PTSD, say, in a response to a disaster. The people with two longs are the ones that make very good Navy SEALs, for instance, because to be a Navy SEAL, you really have to be able to suppress your fears. So that's a biological explanation of a difference in us. It doesn't – biology isn't destiny here, but it is sure a strong influence over what happens. And I think it's not only interesting, but really elucidates something basic about us. By the way, the we can manipulate this system a little bit because the serotonin antidepressants – aim at this. The way they work is they influence the serotonin transporter that I talked about earlier. Yeah. So it's an emerging field of biology that now goes right down to the molecule, information directly from the molecule that really is exciting in our field.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to understand that it's really comes down to also gene expression.
Right.
There was a body of research and a thought going back to the 1800s that biology is destiny. Biology is not, I think biology is potential destiny more than anything else. Mm-hmm. We can overcome a lot of these things. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you had sent some information, and one of the things you did was an experiment. Some rats were infected with some type of a parasite that became less fearful of cats.
Yeah.
Of course, then this behavior led them to being eaten by cats. So
right.
sometimes fear is a good things, but talk a little bit about
that's
that.
That's so fascinating because then they get eaten by cats, and the parasite then reproduces in the intestines of the cats, and then gets passed on. It's part of the life cycle of the parasite. But look how evolution has designed this. It gets in the belly of the cats because it made the rats less fearful of them. And actually, the rats in the experiment would actually seek out the odor of the urine of cats. It's just fascinating how life interacts and different forms of life interact to influence others. And on a basic biological level, it's
Well, so, we'd have to say, though, that basic biological evolutionary process didn't do so well for the rats.
Right.
That's right, in this point. Did well for the parasite. Right.
And I know we've talked on other previous programs about the the use of fear in marketing, but this is what they play off of.
Oh, sure.
I mean, whether it's, like we're in the political season now or, regular advertising, fear is a big motivation.
No, anxiety.
Anxiety. Okay, anxiety.
Anxiety. See, it's so insidious. Yeah. But anxiety is everything about consumerism. If without inducing, if you can't sell a product because someone doesn't need it, well, what do? You have to sort of make them think that they do need it. What do? That you create anxiety in them. Mm-hmm. And then after bringing this person to a heightened level of anxiety, say, but we can cure this anxiety, just buy this product or do this behavior, something like that.
So would you say it's the same for political ads then? It's not that.
Oh, it's the same for the politics. Last night we watched it.
Yeah.
We watched two salesmen, more or less, trying to create anxiety about the other one.
Right. What about fear that's that can be culturally or politically manipulated? Is that still, are we talking anxiety there, or is it fear?
Well, I think you're talking about trying to manipulate a population.
Yeah.
Well, that's very true, too. That's been true for, ever since we have recorded time. Create anxiety in the population, and mostly it's for war-related activities. We must overcome these other people, take their land. If we don't act first, they're going to attack us. We must be defensive. So, yes, we always play on other people's anxieties. That seems to be the trump card that people play on. That would be an interesting source of biological inquiry to see if there's a biological trump card that people just play on others' anxieties.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Hitler is a good example of that. Yeah. He made the German population anxious when they were vulnerable after World War I. Mm-hmm. He made them anxious about Jews, and look what happened.
Right. So you sort of touched upon this, but talk about people who seem to have no fear. Is it they really have no fear, or is it they've learned to control that?
Oh, it's both. And I think there is a piece of biology there. They would probably, if they could, were tested, would have two long forms, most likely, more often than not, would have the two long forms of that gene I was talking about. But there's other genes involved, certainly, and it's much more complicated. First off, there's a basic biological difference. And then there's a learned difference having to do with exposure. One example of people that seem to have no fear are psychopaths. They don't seem to react with the same kind of anxiety and fears and shame, for instance, that motivate everybody else. That's an example where it's very harmful.
Yeah, I think it's true to understand that fear is a healthy and adaptive self-preservation mechanism. We don't really want to have no fear in our lives. We want to have situation where our fear does not control us, but we can have adjustments on our fear and anxiety controls. And psychopaths, even sociopaths to some level, they certainly don't seem to have the same kind of fear responses that most other people do. But undoubtedly, they must be afraid of something, which varies from person to person for the psychopath. And there are some people who are born literally without any kind of fear whatsoever. They tend to have some kind of brain deformation or malfunction that there's missing
mentally
something.
Mentally retarded.
And it's not always as beneficial as you think it might be, because if you have no fear of anything, you might make a really good soldier, but you might not make a really good, husband, wife, dinner companion, friend, brother, sister kind of thing, because you do want to have some social interactions. You do want to have some sensitivities, and you want to be sensitive to others, and of which anxiety is a part of that. So it's not always a great thing not to have any fear about everything.
Sure. And back in around 1908, a couple of psychologists came up with
Yerkes-Dodson law,
which basically says that anxiety, it points out the positive and negative of anxiety. Right. Anxiety is necessary to arouse, pay attention, but if you only up to a point. Mm-hmm. When it keeps rising, then it starts deteriorating performance.
Right.
Whereas up to that point, it serves to improve performance. And they have a graph which they call the Yerkes-Dodson curve.
Like a kind of bell curve kind of thing. But
upside down. Yeah. Bell curve. Yeah. Upside down U, which says that performance increases as anxiety increases up to a point, and then it starts to level off and decrease as anxiety is increasing more, all the way down to zero, and that would probably be the paralyzing.
Your your brain gets so overwhelmed. You know,
again, we've evolved a little bit beyond that in terms of the terminology. That's what they used back then for anxiety. Now we realize there are so many different kinds of forms. You would probably call that now stage fright or a performance anxiety, which means you want to do really well. You have this nervous kind of excitement, which is not really the same as anxiety. But once you get to that point that Mark talked about, you get to the top of the curve, that's when it becomes more debilitating, more anxiety-ish, less helpful kind of thing.
So we all have some sort of fears that we probably would like to be able to control. So how do we do that? How do we do that? How do we overcome the fears that we'd like to overcome?
Well, there are a number of ways to overcome. A lot of books, a lot of motivational speakers. Some people turn to the Bible. Some people turn to people turn to alcohol and drugs. A lot of people do self-medication or self-effacing behaviors, and all of these things are done to try and mitigate our sense of anxiety. When that doesn't happen, it can develop into depression in as little as 2 weeks. So we live in a very anxious time, and people have been saying that for thousands of years. And I think living in the world, for many people, becomes a quest of how do I avoid anxiety? How do I minimize anxiety? How do I evade anxiety? And there's so many different ways. The best way to do that, I think, is to, if you need a coach, get a good behavioral coach or emotional coach or therapist to help teach you how to do that. It's really a learned skill set. You need to learn the skill sets from books, from mentors, from someplace. It's probably not going to happen on your own. What's going to happen on your own is you're going to condition yourself to become more anxious. You know, people who try to teach themselves how to do something, you can learn it from books and movies and things like that, but it's best to get a mentor to save a lot of time and do it the correct way.
Yeah, you're pointing out one of the common fears, obviously, is fear of death. And it's been shown repeatedly that people who have a strong religious conviction and practice are less afraid of death than others.
True.
Whether it's valid or not doesn't matter. But the basic way of deconditioning yourself to fear has to do with exposing yourself to the feared object, kind of coaching yourself.
You graduated exposure, Mark. Let's make sure.
Yeah,
I had this flashback of the 10 years old when the German Shepherd bit me. They tried to want me to pet it.
Right, exactly. So, you know, the phrase is get back on the saddle.
Kind of thing. All right.
It's hard to do.
All right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychologist Michael Abruzzese, as always, thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR station, a service of WGBH.